Hey guys, how's things?
Oh, good.
I guess.
I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network. Is my mic up a little too hot here, man? It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Today on the show, Brad R. Hoff is going to be on. Now, you heard Mitch Prothero on the show. Was that yesterday? You heard Mitch Prothero on the show talking about how America trained the guy who is now the leader of the Islamic State's military. No, not that they controlled him all along and everything like that, and he's only there because they sent him. That kind of deal. It's a little bit of blowback. Oh, but then Brad Hoff develops the story a little bit further. ISIS leader Omar al-Shashani fought under U.S. umbrella as late as 2013. Oh, look at us. We're all a bunch of mythical moderates. Yeah, Brad Hoff back on the show. Brad Hoff, who did the best reporting on the DIA report from August of 2012, where DIA warned that we're creating an Islamic State in eastern Syria and dangerously possibly in western Iraq. Yeah, now, anybody listening to this show knew that. 2011 on. You know, Chalmers Johnson used to say, you know, reading antiwar.com in the morning, you learn way more than if you were getting the CIA early bird newspaper thing that they put out to the top customers, as they call them, in Washington, D.C. And Chalmers Johnson knew because he was a CIA analyst, a contract one for a while anyway. He knew enough about CIA to say, oh man, I way rather read antiwar.com in the morning than get the morning CIA brief. Those idiots. So, yeah, there's some truth in that. Good old Chalmers Johnson. All right, anyway, so Brad Hoff's going to be on the show, and then Eric's going to be here on the show, too. Eric Margulies is going to be on, and also to talk about Syria, but more to talk about, you know, the Russian role, and then I hope we can talk some about Ukraine as well. I really want to talk about, you know, America's role with Russia, with Eric. Obviously, the Syrian context is everything, and I'm going to have to cover some of this myself anyway, because there's just the hugest, freaking craziest Syria war news going on this week that I just, a little bit of it is redundant from what I've told y'all over the last couple of days, but still it's so important I just can't help but go back over it for you. So that's going to be coming up here in a minute. Yeah, and then I guess that's it. Oh, you know, I had a call out to Steven Zunis, and you know what, let me, I'm going to write another note to myself here to call him at the next break. Steven Zunis, back when the war in Mali happened in 2013, Steven Zunis knew all about it already, and so I don't know if he knows about Burkina Faso, but I'm taking a gamble that he knows enough about it that he can talk about the military coup d'etat that took place there yesterday. It's a small country, sort of, kind of, between Nigeria and Mali, I think. You know, I admit, my interstate map of the African continent is not perfect. Let's see. If you gave me a map of Africa, what percentage could I fill out correctly? Yeah, 30, 40, maybe. Anyway, try to learn more about that. Okay, listen, let me tell you about my sponsors. I don't do this enough on the show. I obviously play the ads all the time, but I really should tell you how grateful I am for my sponsors, in case you want to be one too. And I should tell you that I would really appreciate it if you would patronize my sponsors, because no sponsors, no show. And you know, hey, if you show up and you patronize these guys and you let them know that the reason you're doing so is because they're supporting this show, well, then that could help to persuade them to continue supporting the show. And then you can have the great services that they're offering plus the show too. See? Capitalism. Mutually beneficial exchanges all around. All right. First and foremost is Mike Swanson of WallStreetWindow.com, investment advice, and the great book, The War State. Please read it. The War State. You can find it at Amazon.com. You can get the audiobook, of course, as well from Listen and Think Audio. By the way, did I mention Listen and Think Audio also supports this show? Listen and Think Audio will give you a lifetime subscription to their libertarian audiobooks for any $200 donation to The Scott Horton Show. So I know you're thinking, ah, $200, man, I don't know. But then think, dozens already and hundreds more in the future. Libertarian audiobooks from now on for free for you. That's Listen and Think. And then there's Phil Giraldi's group, the Council for the National Interest. It's basically the Contra, the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C. And they do great work there, the Council for the National Interest. Liberty.me, of course, helps sponsor the show, and I do two shows for them, Eye on the Empire with Jeff Tucker and The Future of Freedom with Jacob Hornberger there. The LibertyStickers.com, of course, I invented it and sold it to Rick, and he's kept it in business for 11 years now. I love it. Every time I go in there, he's got these awesome printers, man. You should see it. They should have pictures of their printers on their website so you can be impressed by just, man, every time I go in there, I joke about how they're just printing money. Just stickers coming out of all these machines at top speed, getting cut up and shipped off. He's made a great company out of thebumpersticker.com and libertystickers.com. So there's that. You guys should, and seriously, man, let them know, hey, Scott was saying that you guys got stickers for my band, my business, whatever I need. Let them know that you heard about it here. Roberts and Roberts Brokerage, Inc. These guys have been very generous. They're very good guys, hardcore libertarians like us, and they absolutely hate war, and they're brokers in precious metals. Now, if you understand economics, you know you need some precious metals. At least, you know, some portion of your savings have got to be in metals. And these guys will hook you up. Platinum, palladium, gold, silver, whatever. They take a very modest commission, and they're incredibly honest and trustworthy and reliable and have a great reputation going back decades. And you should do business with them. Roberts and Roberts Brokerage, Inc., Tim Frey and them. That's rrbi.co. The Future Freedom Foundation, I mentioned them when I mentioned Hornberger there. They also help to support this show. Subscribe to their news. I mean, you get their daily stuff, but all their best articles come out in The Future Freedom. It's a monthly journal, and you can get the online version for only $15. That's at fff.org/subscribe for The Future Freedom. And we're talking Hornberger and Bovard and Richard Ebeling and, you know, top quality, hardcore, plumb line libertarians. Like Hornberger, they're not all necessarily anarchists, but at least they're radical minarchists. They mean it. They're state haters. And then, man, who am I missing? I better look at my website and make sure that I'm not missing anybody. Go-Kart Galaxy, of course, Clint has bought a web ad all this time on the site, which is nice if you need mini bike parts or go-kart parts of any kind for, you know, hobbyists in your family, Christmas presents for your kids, whatever like that. Check them out at Go-Kart Galaxy. My newest one, Master Samurai Tech. I even was just thinking of him a second ago and then spaced it out. Scott Brown, Master Samurai Tech. This guy trains you how to repair all the fancy new big appliances, refrigerators and all that stuff. Affordable courses, real expert training there. So check them out. Oh, and Darren's Coffee. Drink coffee at darrenscoffee.com. A lot of it. Free shipping if you use promo code Scott. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, news. Coming up, Brad Hoff. So stay tuned for that. Let me check these headlines. The Houthi thing. I gotta cover that later. Oh, yeah, I got a Yemen thing for you guys, man, here in a minute. Stupid Benjamin Netanyahu. All right, too much stuff going on here. Iran deal. U.S. starts carrying out nuke deal as time expires on GOP. Senior diplomat named to lead efforts. This is the Associated Press. The Obama administration began carrying out the Iran nuclear deal Thursday as time expired on Republican efforts to derail it, appointing a senior diplomat to ensure that Tehran moves further away from bomb-making capability and outlining a months-long process before Western nations will start easing economic sanctions. Senators failed to reach the 60-vote threshold for a measure to keep all sanctions in place on Iran until it recognizes Israel and releases all imprisoned Americans, and then on another resolution expressing disapproval of the nuclear agreement. Two previous votes in recent days against the Iran deal also failed, and Congress's 60-day window to prevent Obama from implementing the Seven-Nation Pact was set to close Thursday night. Shortly after the votes, the State Department named Stephen Mull as, quote, lead coordinator for Iran nuclear implementation. Mull, who has served as ambassador to Poland and in other top diplomatic posts, takes on the, quote, crucial responsibility of shepherding an agreement which will make the United States and blah, yeah, it'll make us all safer, says Kerry. Shut up, stupid John Kerry. Hate you. Anyway. All right, cool, man. I like that. And then, this is Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Senate rejects two new anti-Iran votes ahead of the deadline. So remember Jim Loeb was on. We talked all about the poison pills and Israel's plan B for America's politics and how they were going to figure out a way to kill this thing after all, etc. Well, so far they're failing. Writes Jason Ditz, the 60-day deadline for Congress to review the P5+1 nuclear deal with Iran expires today. This is yesterday's story. And the Senate held yet another vote trying to get beyond a filibuster of the bill aimed at blocking the pact. Once again, the vote failed by a 56-42 vote. Wow, I didn't realize it was like that. Short of the 60 needed to get past the filibuster and well short of the 67 that they would need to override a veto. The House passed a resolution earlier this week, but not with a veto-proof majority anyhow. All right. This puts an end to Syria's congressional attempts to block the deal. Though some House Republicans are talking about filing a lawsuit, trying to get the 60-day deadline reset. Yeah, I guess that probably includes Justin Amash, right? And then, I thought this was hilarious, man. Post-deal Iran asks if U.S. is still Great Satan or something less. This is in the New York Times. Thomas Erdbrink. Tehran, a new struggle is unfolding in Iran, where the top leaders have begun to tackle the question of how to deal with their great enemy after having reached a nuclear agreement with the United States. The Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and President Hassan Rouhani have been offering starkly opposing visions of Iran's post-deal future, reflecting their divergent attitudes toward the Great Satan. We have announced that we will not negotiate with the Americans on any issue other than the nuclear case, Mr. Khamenei said this month. speaking to a group of hardline students recently. He was even more explicit, telling them to, quote, prepare for the continuation of the fight against America. By contrast, Mr. Rouhani said on Sunday that the nuclear agreement reached after 2 years of torturous negotiations was not the end of the way, but a beginning for creating an atmosphere of friendship and cooperation with various countries. And by the way, I should say about that quote of Khamenei, I hadn't read the whole thing, but I can guarantee you that that's in the context of him explaining why the Americans are not going to let up on us. And so we have to be prepared to continue to resist and maintain our independence. That's virtually always the context that those quotes come out of. Quite literally out of. You know, like he says, oh yeah, well if you guys don't lift the sanctions like in the deal, well you know, we could get back to spending more centrifuges, and then the tweet goes out, oh, Supreme Leader threatens to start spending more centrifuges. They're trying to tire me. It's not working though. Okay, it's working a little bit. Anyway, so how the opposing visions are ultimately resolved may be uncertain, but as the nuclear pact is carried out and the sanctions are lifted, Iran's favorite scapegoat can no longer plausibly be regarded as the root of all evil in the world. Quote, our great Satan without sanctions is just not the same anymore, said Saeed Laylaz, an economist and supporter of Mr. Rouhani. Perhaps we should use lesser Satan now, or something like that. In a highly controlled society like Iran, the leaders rarely speak spontaneously, so there's a certain premeditated good cop, bad cop aspect to the public posturing about the United States. But the dueling perspectives also reflect the problem of fitting the new, softer image of the U.S. into Iran's founding ideological narrative. They mean the Islamic Republic. Iran's been around 37 years after the revolution, those longing for Iran to... And anyway, here's where to stop reading and just start making sure that everybody understands the history here. You know, like a year ago, actually, something like that, I was getting my air conditioner fixed, and the guy that was... Well, it's a really old, crappy truck, and it's broken a lot of the time. So anyway, the guy that was fixing the truck... Man, we were just hitting it off and agreeing on all kinds of foreign policy things, man. Iraq and this, that, the other thing, and then it came to... Oh, but Iran, they hate us. They just hate us. They just hate us. And I forget if I asked. I think I just let it be. But the, and then just talked about it on the radio instead. But the point being that, you know, nobody just hates anybody, man. And history didn't begin in 1979 any more than it began in 2001. America overthrew the government of Iran in 1953, and they maintained an American sock puppet fascist military dictatorship over those millions and millions and millions of human beings for 26 years until they rose up and overthrew the bastard. That's why they named us the Great Satan. Not because Shia Islam makes people hate whoever happens to live in the middle part of North America. No, it was because of Ike Eisenhower and Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon and Ford and Carter all supporting a fascist dictatorship in their country. Now, that's not hard to understand if you know it.
Iran, because of the great leadership of the Shah, is an island of stability in one of the more troubled areas of the world. This is a great tribute to you, Your Majesty, and to your leadership, and to the respect and the admiration and love which your people give to you.
Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send him a message at commoditydiscs.com or check him out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Oh, you know what? I screwed up the time zone. That makes sense. I better update this tweet then. Actually, oh man, I can't talk and write. Yeah, this is my show, the Scott Horton Show. So somebody just asked me a question on Twitter. Let me give her a second to click through. I kind of referred to this offhand there real quick in the last segment. The House complaining. Why didn't they get their supermajority? Because some of them were complaining that the Obama administration never lived up to their end of the original Iran Deal Review Act thing, which is stupid technicalitarian nonsense. Well, it's a different term. Really should apply there, but anyway, the question in the chat room was, hope I've given her enough time to go ahead and tune in now. The question in the chat room was, have you addressed the unreleased documents regarding the Iran deal? And this is what some of the members of the House are trying to cry about, is that the language of the deal says that they get to see all of the deal. Well, of course, part of the deal is that the Iranians make arrangements with the International Atomic Energy Agency regarding how to implement the terms of the agreement. And those deals are between Iran and the IAEA, not Iran and the P5 plus one. And anyway, it's just a stupid pretended excuse to have something to cry about, because you know, these are all the very same people who say, oh, boo-hoo, the IAEA isn't satisfied about this or isn't satisfied about that anytime it confirms their bias. Now, all of a sudden, they would have us believe that, oh, yeah, the IAEA is Iran's fifth column inside the world government. And, you know, they're just going to help them get away with concealing their nuclear activities or some such thing. When, in fact, there's been plenty written by the international inspector types all about how this works. You know, that was why when George John's obviously wrong story came out about how the inspections at Parchin were to take place, he had Tariq Ralph, who's a former IAEA inspector, write that this is so wrong that it must be a forgery. And in fact, he was on this show and he said that the reason he assumed it was a forgery was because he knows George John, and he's George Yan, I guess, at AP. And he's a good reporter, so I gotta give him the benefit of the doubt. He couldn't possibly have screwed it up this bad. Give me a break. Iran gets to inspect all their own equipment. That's funny, because that's not how it's done ever anywhere. And if you think that they're gonna make that special deal for Iran now in the midst of these politics, then you're not thinking, you're just a right-wing slogan monger with an Israel first agenda. That's all. Oh, that wasn't in his essay. That's me elaborating a little bit. Because the way it works is, yeah, the Iranians take the swipes, but the IAEA guy is standing right there and with a video camera. And then the Iranian takes the swipe and puts it in the plastic bag, and off it goes to the evidence locker. And as Yosef Butt wrote at, where did he write this? I think probably for Bloomberg. They have every reason to want to do that, because even just recently, if you look at the Israeli bombing of the non-nuclear reactor in Syria in 2007, that was just a giant lie. The only so-called evidence of the uranium, guess what, came from a swipe that was taken without any of the other protocols in place. One inspector said, ooh, look at me, I got a rogue swipe from the floor of the bathroom, and then he put it in his shirt pocket. And lo and behold, out of all the environmental samples from the entire site, that was the one that showed a tiny bit of a uranium isotope on it. Yeah, well, it was more likely from the inspector's shirt than from the bathroom where he got the swipe. And it didn't go in a plastic bag, and it wasn't observed by anybody else. And so it makes perfect sense that they would say, well, we're going to have a mutually agreed upon system for doing this. And Reuters, of course, came out, and I think I have it here. No, I don't. I had it yesterday. Well, I told you about it the other day. Where Reuters came out and completely debunked George John's reporting and said they've now seen the document, and clearly what it says is that the IAEA will be there. Now, will be where and when, what now? All of Iran's nuclear facilities, all of Iran's nuclear facilities, including the mines, will be under 24-hour inspection and surveillance and safeguarding. When you hear about any delay in the inspections, that's only if the Iranians want to fight about it and make a big try to make an excuse about it. The longest conceivable possible time that they could delay, if they did everything they could to try to delay, would be 24 days. And there's no reason to expect that that's what they're... And we're talking about non-nuclear facilities. We're talking about a suspicious site because Israel sent the Mujahideen cult, communist terrorist cult, to funnel some bogus crap to the Washington Times or something. Or the London Times, even worse. And so, oh, now there's a suspicious site. Let's go inspect it. Well, they just signed a deal that says, give us 24 hours notice and you can come anywhere. Okay, so worst case scenario, they can drag it out for 24 days. But then they wouldn't be able to cover up anything that they were doing with nuclear material in 24 days anyway. Or even in 24 years, as Yosef Butt put it. And besides, all we're talking about here is inspecting Parchin. That's the only, and there's Maravan, but the IAEA has already been invited out to Maravan long before this deal was ever done, and they won't go out there because they know that it's just a bunch of probably Israeli made-up crap about what supposedly was going on out there. But then, when it comes to Parchin, we all already know that there never was a test chamber. That's not how you test an implosion system for a nuclear bomb anyway. There's no reason to believe the thing ever existed other than some Colin Powell-level cartoon drawing of what it might have looked like if there ever was such a thing. And it's so easily disproven and debunked. Robert Kelly, the former chief inspector of the International Atomic Energy Agency, wrote about how, never even mind that the so-called former Soviet nuclear weapons scientist was nothing of the sort. They say Soviet because they don't want to say Ukrainian because that's not as scary as Russian. So they have to resort to former Soviet nuclear weapons scientist. Wasn't a nuclear scientist at all. Never mind weapons. Wasn't a nuclear scientist at all. His name was Danilenko, and his specialty was implosion systems for production of nanodiamonds for industry. Nothing to do with nuclear detonations or fission whatsoever. And then plus, all of the paperwork doesn't even make sense. So they designed and commissioned the building of this thing and completed the building of it and started testing implosion systems in it all within 1 year, huh? According to your lies. Yeah, right. Case closed. You're lying. You can read about the Parchin puzzle at loblog.com by Robert Kelly. Completely. And in fact, he wrote about this at atomicreporters.org, where he just debunked this over and over and over again. There's nothing to find at Parchin. This is made up crap anyway at Parchin. And anyway, back to the original question. The Congress doesn't have the authority to insist on seeing bilateral agreements between the International Atomic Energy Agency and any other sovereign state. That's it. And never mind that it's a whole bogus bunch of crap anyway. An excuse thin enough for Justin Amash, maybe, but not for a human being.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back. It's my show, Scott Horton's show. Coming up, Brad R. Hoff. Nope. First, Eric Margulies. See, I had the thing screwed up there. First, Eric Margulies is going to be on the show. Then Brad Hoff. Oops. Anyway, yeah, that'll be cool, man. Here in just a few. I don't know. I guess I do want to talk about the Iran deal a little bit more for you, because I think this is helpful for people, just because hardly anybody knows about the deal. And the people who are for the deal, mostly, at least, you know, the people in power, they're all using the president's slogan about how, oh, this is preventing war and whatever, which is actually the same kind of stupid sloganeering that the war party uses. You know, you should be too afraid to look into the details. Just trust me. Well, I hate Democrats. God, they're so horrible. Anyway, here's what's good about the Democrats' Iran deal, all right? First of all, it's not even necessary at all. The Iranians were never making nuclear weapons. The Iranians are members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They have a quote-unquote unalienable right to peaceful nuclear technology, including the enrichment fuel cycle. And the U.S. and the entire U.N. Security Council are actually all members of that treaty, too, and are bound to respect their unalienable rights, but don't. And so, using mostly Israeli threats of aggressive war, they've built up this massive regime of economic warfare, sanctions, and, you know, virtual blockade against the economy of Iran, the people of Iran, in order to attempt to compel their government to accede to our demands. So now they have. And I was watching a libertarian the other day hosting a show. I could tell these guys kind of mean well, but they just get all their information from right-wing sources. They never hear anyone debunk it in any kind of meaningful way, and so it just stands unchallenged as far as they know. And the quote was, what do we get out of the deal? Nothing. Well, if he means we, the American people, what we get out of the deal is a much lessened threat of war with Iran, which would be horrible for us as well as them. And the whole world economy and everything else, that's one thing we get out of it. A lessened threat of war by people who are constantly threatening to launch one over this civilian safeguarded NPT sanctified nuclear program. But here's what else we get out of it. We, in terms of the American empire, its Israeli ally, what our side gets out of the nuclear deal is the Iranians are turning off 75% of their centrifuges, will be disconnected. They're going from 20,000 centrifuges down to just over 5,000. Okay? That's one thing that they're doing. They're reconfiguring the Iraq reactor so that it could not possibly produce weapons-grade plutonium. The plutonium that will produce as waste will be so polluted, if it produces plutonium at all, I guess. I think they're just making a light water reactor. It'll make it so polluted with isotopes that even if they had a reprocessing facility that they do not have, they wouldn't be able to ever get all the crap out of it and be able to use it for fission anyway. And certainly they wouldn't be able to do any of that without the entire world knowing that that was what they're doing. Because, of course, you have to turn off the reactor, wait for the waste to cool down a little bit. Sometimes that takes as long as half a year or a year. And then at least the Bushehr, I guess, they would have to take the roof off of the thing. I don't know about Iraq. But anyway, point is, at both of their nuclear reactors, Bushehr and Iraq, they will not be producing plutonium-239 as waste. They will be unable to produce plutonium-239 as waste. Okay? They're closing down their facility at Fordo, or at least they're turning it into simply a research facility with no nuclear material whatsoever. They were enriching up to 20% there before for their medical isotope reactor, which was really just a bargaining chip, something to give up, but so they did. They gave it up. And they, again, have already had a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency all along. But now they are adopting an additional protocol to their safeguards agreement and subsidiary arrangements under their safeguards agreement. And what those stupid, silly international law jargon terms mean is they're expanding inspections beyond all historical precedent. They're expanding inspections to the mines, to the factories where they make the centrifuges, where there's no nuclear material whatsoever. And they're expanding their inspections to full-scale 24-hour permanent surveillance at all nuclear sites in Iran. And that's why Ted Cruz has to lie like a damned dog in the Republican debate when Kasich says, well, you know, if I'm president, we're going to wait around and see if they cheat or not. I mean, if they implement the deal, then that's kind of cool, whatever. And Ted Cruz, oh, you're a commie, you're a liberal, you're a weakling. Let me tell you about what's so horrible about the deal. Now, actually, I'd missed this part of the debate, but I read the quote this morning. And the only thing that Ted Cruz can do to try to debunk this deal and say it's a bad deal is to claim that all inspections in Iran under the nuclear deal come with a 24-day advanced warning. Oh, please. Now, this is the George Bush strategy. You can fool some people all of the time, and those are the ones you want to concentrate on. Again, the unspoken first half of every sentence out of a Republican's mouth is, hey, you pathetic, stupid, subhuman idiot who believes in me, listen to this and repeat it. They get 24 days prior notice before any inspections happen in Iran, okay? Now, go out there and believe that, you stupid, pathetic, subhuman weasel. You moron. They're under permanent 24-hour surveillance inspection forever. White lab coat, left hand holding a tricorder from now on. And if you think that Ted Cruz is right, it's because you are stupid and your stupid brain doesn't work good. But then probably you wouldn't be listening to the show anyway. Yeah, because that makes total sense, right? That was the deal that Kerry and all of our European allies and Obama and all them worked out. Is that, yeah, they'll have 24 days advance notice before any inspections take place anywhere, huh? Great argument. And then instead of saying, shut up, you stupid idiot demagogue liar, and you shut up too, Jake Tapper, and let me finish. Ted Cruz, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. I guess John Kasich just, you know, rolled over on his back. Oh, whatever you say, Ted Cruz. What did I do? Read the deal? But it's dozens of pages long. I mean, There you go. So that's what America gets. We are taking a safeguarded civilian nuclear program, and we are now making it, as the Japanese would say, a double extra happy lucky wish, super duper inspected and safeguarded civilian nuclear program. Oh, I left out the part where they're reducing their stockpile of low enriched uranium, their 3.6% industrial grade, electricity grade uranium. They're limiting their stockpile to just the most minimal amounts, where now they have a few thousand pounds worth of it. They're going to use it all up. They're converting it all into fuel plates and fuel rods. They're going to use it all up, and they're going to oxidize whatever. They've agreed to oxidize any surplus that they've got and make it useless so that it could not be used for nuclear weapons, even in a Norman Podhoretz type hypothetical. So, there you go, man. That's the deal. It was always a tempest in a teapot. It was always, as Gareth Porter proves beyond any shadow of a doubt in his book, a manufactured crisis. A big, fake, stupid crisis by a bunch of lying, crybaby Israelis and their fifth column in America. Everybody who knows anything about the Iran nuclear issue and is not a liar could have told you anything I just said this whole time. I mean, about the history of their program, whatever. How it's not a nuclear weapons program. How, at worst case scenario, they had done some research into what it would take, and all that halted back in 2003. That, and hell, you can read in Haaretz where even Mossad assents to the CIA's conclusion on that. And you can read in secret Mossad documents that they shared with the South Africans how that's their conclusion too. Just look up the South Africa-Israel cables. It'll come right up for you. Add nuclear, I guess, to your search. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at DarrensCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. DarrensCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. DarrensCoffee.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Sorry, yeah, I did screw up the time zones earlier. I'm used to talk at all times Eastern, and but Brad, he lives here in Texas near me, man, and so he's coming on next after our good friend Eric Margolese, author of War at the Top of the World and American Raj Liberation or Domination, and about 500,000 news stories and columns or so, I'm guessing, that he's written in his career. Cover 14 wars, knows everything about every one of them, and speaks all the languages, too. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How the hell are you, man?
Oh, I'm glad to be back with you, Scott. There's lots to talk about these days.
Man, there's so...
Last week.
Yeah, no, there's so much we couldn't possibly cover at all, but let's start with this. How much should I hate Russia, and how much should I fear them?
I'll tell you what I think. I don't either hate them or fear them. Russia is a huge country with a very rich and often tragic history that commands awe and respect. Russians can be frightening if you're in a war with them. The moral is don't fight with people who are shaped to the size of refrigerators. And the Russians have their own interests, like any other major country. We can't decide with the Russians whether to treat them like a normal country or to treat them like some kind of devil. They're not.
Yeah. All right. Well, so anyway, and obviously I was just kidding. But the thing is, so have they ever actually, I mean, since the end of the Cold War, they've really done anything to us at all other than, you know, since the rise of Putin, declare independence?
Absolutely not. President Putin, you'll notice in our media now, he's never called President Putin anymore. It's always Putin. Russia has done nothing. The worst that Russia has done to the United States is refuse to roll over and follow orders.
All right. Now, I know this is a little bit redundant. We've talked about this before, but it's so important. And I know it's new people listening all the time. And
George Kennan, of course, who began the to write Mr. X, who came up with the containment policy against the Soviet Union so many years ago after World War II. He did an interview with Thomas Friedman in the New York Times in 1998, and he said, basically warned about against NATO expansion, and said how obvious it would be that what was coming, that as we expand NATO into Eastern Europe, the Russians will react. And by the way, these are the guys who overthrew the communists for us. We ought to worship them, basically. Instead, we're sticking our finger in their eye, and by moving our military, you know, NATO is not just a building with, you know, people with ribbons or what. It's a military alliance. And as we push our military alliance east, they will react. And then all the people who are saying they won't react now will be the same people saying, see, this is why we need NATO so bad, because of all this Russian aggression and all that. And we'll call their reaction the start of the fight. And it was just, it couldn't have been predicted or laid out any clearer. And it's exactly what's happening, you know, at this moment. And the reason I started off with how much should I hate him, how much should I fear him, is because this is absolutely the consensus in every bit of TV media, every bit of political conversation everywhere. Putin and Russia are the boogeyman, maybe even as bad as it was, you know, when I was a kid in the 1980s under Reagan, when they were still the commies. And it's just unanimous. It's sort of like listening to right-wingers talk about the nuclear deal. None of them have ever heard anyone else actually contradict them with any facts, so they really think they're right. I mean, it's just a nationwide groupthink, basically.
Well, that's right. And, you know, back in 1990, I think it was 91 or 92, somewhere back there, I wrote, I remember writing a couple of columns saying, great that the wall has come down, hooray for the return of Eastern Europe to free nations, but whatever, don't push NATO east. And Gorbachev had said that many times. There was a verbal agreement between the U.S. and the Russians, post-Soviet Russians, not to push NATO east in return for Russia not allowing these East European countries to get away from the thumb of Russia. We were very close to war in those days, and I, in fact, said that Gorbachev was the man who avoided World War III for us. But nevertheless, we made a fatal mistake. Greed and lust overcame sensible thinking. And the Europeans were weak-willed, too, and showed how much they are vassals of the United States, because they went along with this too. And in the end, we've pushed our borders right up to Russia, and the perfectly expected result has happened. That is, the Russians are pushing back and are very, very upset, feel we're surrounding them, which we are.
All right, now I want to get back to Eastern Europe in a minute, but your article about Russia today at LouRockwell.com is mostly regarding Syria here. And I wonder, first of all, if you think that if it's even true, the newly increased amount of Russian intervention on the side of Assad there, I'm sure it's not as extensive as it's being portrayed. But then secondly, I wonder if you think that that's a real indication of how bad Assad and the Syrian state now need Russian help. That, you know, Hezbollah and Iran aren't cutting it. They need the Russians. Otherwise, they're risking losing their capital city here, that kind of thing. What do you think?
That's right. I think the Syrian government is stretched very thin. It can't recruit any new soldiers. It's fighting on so many fronts. It's in very dangerous situation. And I tell you, the bigger danger is not so much the anti-Assad forces pushing towards Damascus, but of a coup from within the current Syrian government military forces to oust Assad and put in somebody harder line there, because he's a pretty soft guy. He's not the monster that the Western propaganda machine portrays him to be. But they are being pushed very hard, and he's an important Russian ally, and I'm afraid that we are going to force Russia to intervene to some degree.
And now, you know, what's funny about all this is just how funny it all is. I mean, the whole thing's obviously a massive tragedy, but the funny part is how no one in American media or politics can talk straight about this at all. that they, you know, the Russians, that just the word Russian is supposed to be unsettling enough that you don't really follow the chain of logic of who's fighting on whose side here. I mean, what's happening here is, as Pat Buchanan writes at antiwar.com today, Putin is basically acting as a surrogate of, if not the American empire, of the American people. He's going to kill our enemies for us, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And the Americans, the American government and the political establishment and the media would have us boo-hooing about that? Crying about the fact that Russia wants to go and do what our government not necessarily should have been doing, but the opposite of what our government has been doing, which is backing our enemies in Syria for the last 4 years straight?
Well, it's true. You know, Putin pulled our chestnuts out of the fire when Obama was going to blunder into attacking Syria over that phony poison gas issue. And then now Putin has, President Putin has offered very sensible direct talks on the military situation with Washington, scorned by the Obama administration. You know, we've got to stop demonizing our rivals and our opponents. Otherwise, we can't conduct any sensible, mature policy.
Yeah. And by the way, everybody, you should know that possibly preceded by one story in The Guardian, I forget the guy's name who wrote about Prince Bandar is sending Mujahideen to Syria already. That was in, I'm pretty sure, June or July of 2011. I think you were second in an article that ran at lourockwell.com that wasn't just, hey, this is what it looks like to me. It was, hey, I just got back from France, and my sources in French intelligence and the military have told me that the French, i.e. NATO, America, they're, and France is just one of our satellites, they are on the ground right now in Syria helping organize this thing. So you're at the very least second place, maybe even first place, on American and allied GCC and NATO intervention in Syria back 4 years ago, more than 4 years ago now. So everybody, check out Eric and his archive at ericmargulies.com, and we'll be right back in just a sec with more.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Eric Margulies, author of American Raj, Liberation or Domination. EricMargulies.com. Spell it like Margolis. EricMargulies.com. And read him today at LouRockwell.com. The Russians are coming to help Hezbollah and Assad kill Al-Qaeda guys. And you were saying there, maybe even head off a coup from within the Ba'ath Party. And it's interesting you mentioned that because, two just hugely important stories this week that got very little coverage with the debate and all this other crap. But first of all, Russia says Syria's Assad is ready to share power. And of course, if Russia says so, you know, it goes, basically, I guess. Like when Israel says something, America does it, that kind of thing. So they're willing to negotiate that. Of course, the American standard has been, no, he must agree to step aside before any negotiations can begin, which is, of course, an offer they can't possibly accept. An obvious poison pill, Rambouillet Accord style thing there. Secondly is this one, Eric. West ignored Russian offer in 2012 to have Syria's Assad step aside. And not just 2012, Eric. February 2012, Russia tried to make a deal where they get rid of Assad and work out some kind of a deal, and the American empire completely ignored it and refused to go along with it whatsoever. What do you make of that?
And that's right, Scott. It did happen. And there are a number of reasons. First of all, the U.S. doesn't want to bring it, lower itself to negotiate with a minor power like Russia, as some leading American recently called it. Equally important, it was very hard for anyone there to find reasonable people to negotiate with in Syria. The so-called Syrian moderates have almost vanished into the woodwork. They're the ones being financed by the U.S. and Turkey and France and Israel. And now really the people who are calling the shots there are different kinds of wild men, jihadists, who are being supported by the Saudis and the Gulf states and armed by the U.S. And they are very, very angry people and divided amongst themselves. So very hard to find a negotiating partner. One wasn't found. Eventually one may emerge, but not yet.
Well, you know, it makes sense, though, that the Americans, you know, I mean, obviously it's more complicated than the deal that the Russians pulled off after the sarin false flag attack that by the Turks and al-Nusra that you mentioned earlier there in 2013. But it does seem like, I mean, and obviously, yeah, you can't negotiate with Golani, you know, the leader of al-Nusra, who's still loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri and murders people for being Druze and refusing to renounce it and convert and that kind of thing. But what you could do, I mean, assuming that the Americans were negotiating in good faith here whatsoever, is they could negotiate with the Russians that if you guys will support some kind of transition of, you know, Assad leaving, but short of de-Ba'athifying the government and abolishing the army, then we will do our part to tell the Turks and the Israelis and the Saudis and the Qataris that before we were obviously lying when we said so, but now we actually really mean it. Stop bankrolling the Islamic State. And there are satellites. Push comes to shove. Qatar's going to do what the hell they're told. No?
Yes, they will if we put enough pressure on them.
So the Islamic State, we don't have to deal with them and we don't have to deal with Al-Qaeda, but we can make everyone stop paying them and we can make the Turks close the damned border and stop buying black market oil from them and this kind of thing at least. And then, you know, it's not a matter of allying with Assad, but hell, let the Russians ally with Assad and let him recreate his old monopoly, you know, to the Sykes-Picot line.
Well, yes, that's right, Scott, but the problem here is that ISIS, Islamic State, whatever you want to call them, is a helpmate of the United States. It's doing, it's working for us. It's beneficial for the U.S. That's why over recent months we've seen the phony bombing of Kobani on the Turkish border, and we've seen this half-hearted, half-assed air campaign against the Islamic State. We're probably alerted when the planes are coming. We have the recent embarrassing revelations in Congress that the so-called U.S. trained moderate Syrians, they spent $500 million training these guys. There are only 4 to 6 of them left, and they're running away as fast as they can. So we are really half-hearted about fighting ISIS. We need it. It's useful. It's our ally in Iraq, in Syria and Iraq.
Okay, and so now obviously it's useful for the Turks and the Saudis and the Qataris and the Israelis' interests in getting rid of Assad or, you know, limiting Iranian influence in Syria, if you want to put it that way. But what does it do? How does that benefit America at all? Or, I mean, the empire. Obviously, I don't mean the American people. We have no say in this whatsoever. But I just mean, how is that even good for the empire?
The only reason that we're doing this and that we have destroyed Syria and created over 9 million refugees and 250,000 dead is that we're trying to get at Iran still and overthrowing, it is believed in Washington on Israeli advice, that overthrowing Assad will really undermine Iran and overturn its most important ally. This is true, but is that it's worth creating all this havoc and misery and these floods of refugees coming out? I don't think so. I've never understood why we're after Assad at all. He seems to me like he was a natural American ally.
Well, and again, it's because of our allies and their interests more than anything. And yeah, I mean, I just don't think that I've never heard of any other explanation than that. And that's, of course, Obama's explanation himself in the interview with Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic as president of the United States. I do not bluff. If you read in there, Goldberg says, hey, don't you think regime change against Assad is a great way to help, you know, take Iran down a peg? And Obama says, yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. And then he even makes a joke along the lines of, I'd tell you more, but then I'd have to kill you kind of thing. It's classified. I can't tell you everything that we're doing, but that's what we're doing. And that's why we're doing it.
We're doing the same thing that we did in Libya. We're sparking some so-called public protests that are engineered by us. We are then sending in covert special forces to attack the government troops. And then we're creating so much trouble that we're intervening militarily. I've said since 2011 that there are French special forces operating inside of Syria, and probably some British and American special forces, too. You see these knocked-out Syrian tanks, even T-72 modern tanks. They're knocked out with powerful anti-tank missiles that really only our Western special forces operate. So we're up to our ears in this fight, but the question is, why overthrow Assad? Because when he's gone, we are definitely going to miss him.
Yeah, that's right. People think they got a humanitarian crisis now. Just wait till the de-Ba'athification comes, and there's a death mark on the head of every last Druze and Shia and Christian and most of the Sunnis in Syrian society, too, man. Just getting started. Hey, tune into the show after this. You're going to want to hear this next interview. Thanks. It's Eric Margulies, everybody. EricMargulies.com, LouRockwell.com. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Okay, guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Next up is Brad Hoff from LevantReport.com. Welcome back, Brad. How are you?
Always great to be on, Scott. Thank you.
Very happy to have you here. Hey, so this article, right now you can find it at LevantReport.com. We'll be running it over the weekend. Probably the spotlight article over the weekend at antiwar.com as well, in case you need to find it there. Hell of a headline. Great follow-up from yesterday's interview with Mitch Prothero. Islamic State leader Omar al-Shashani fought under U.S. umbrella as late as 2013. So just real quick, in case anybody missed it, Mitch Prothero at McClatchy Newspapers did a story about this guy that he had actually met back in 2008. He was an American trained, a sergeant or something, I think, in the Georgian military, was a hero, quote unquote, of the war with Russia that Saakashvili started in 2008. And then, he decided, along with a lot of the other people from his town, his age, to up and move off to Turkey and go to fight the jihad against Syria. The one that, as we just talked about with Eric Margulies, could have been avoided completely back in 2011 and 12. But anyway, so now apparently Brad Hoff read Mitch Prothero's piece and was reminded of something or something and went and did this follow-up for us. Please do tell, sir.
So much of the article is based on a fairly recent book that just came out this year, last spring, by a freelance journalist named Benjamin Hall, who writes for the New York Times and various other publications. But he wrote a book called Inside ISIS, The Brutal Rise of a Terrorist Army, and he was embedded among rebels in northern Syria in 2012 to 2013. And most significant, he has a whole chapter dealing with this major battle, which marked a turning point in terms of the rebel advance on Aleppo. The rebels had had this important air base under siege. It's called Meneg Air Base, and the battle, which kind of went on and off for 2 years, and the last final siege went on a period of 8 months, was a huge, huge morale booster when the rebels actually finally captured the air base from the government in August of 2013. But this embedded journalist writes that the big turning point was when Omar the Chechen and his band of Chechen jihadists showed up, and they came right in to within the local military command structure, which at that time was the Revolutionary Military Council of Aleppo, directly backed by the United States and Britain, with our man Colonel Abdul-Jabbar al-Qaidi in charge. And Omar the Chechen fit right in, and he sent his suicide bombers to attack the base. And Benjamin Hall, in this new book, describes that singular point as the turning point. Here's a quote from the book. The base only fell when the FSA were joined by the ISIS leader Abu Omar Shoshani and his brutal gang of Chechens. When we had been there, it had been under the sole control of badly funded, badly armed rebels with little knowledge of tactical warfare. But as soon as Shoshani arrived, Omar the Chechen, he took control of the operation and the base fell soon after. So he says the so-called secular moderate rebels only made headway in Aleppo province when Omar the Chechen showed up.
All right, and now, well, I think we've kind of known all along that really the fighters who are doing any winning actually against Assad are the guys who don't mind dying. In other words, guys who are the furthest things from what you'd call moderate. or moderates. And, so yeah, here's the case in point, right? The moderates hang back and snipe, if they are moderate at all, hang back and snipe from the border. Then come in the guys who really mean business, send in the suicide bombers and get the work done. But now, so, geez, I don't know, Brad, Syria's far away. There's a lot of territory, at play here, a lot of it in flux, a lot of different groups with names I've never heard of and so forth. And so maybe this is just a thing. What exactly is the connection, or how tight is that connection between the Revolutionary Military Council of Aleppo, the United States and its allies, and then this guy, this Colonel Al-Qaidi, as you describe it? Who then, I guess if you could also elaborate on his relationship with Omar the Chechen, you know, from there as well. Because, you know, an apologist would say, well, we back the mythical moderates, and you know what? Yeah, it's true. One time some suicide bombers showed up and helped them, but still they're our enemies and we're just very moderate or whatever, and that'd be the end of it, right? That's what the Democrats would say.
Right. So, yeah, when 2012 and summer 2013, I mean, ISIS was just another group no one had ever heard of either. And that's what allowed them to very seamlessly enter within this command structure with Colonel Al-Qaidi on top. So that's what's interesting. I mean, we now see Omar the Chechen's red-bearded face all over the media. And you trace his role in the Syrian conflict back to 2012-2013, he's serving under the command of these guys like Al-Qaidi that we directly back. An interesting thing about Al-Qaidi is that he was a big media sensation in 2012 and especially in 2013 because Ambassador to Syria, Robert Ford, who's the U.S. State Department's top man in Syria, was, you know, going into Syria and having his picture taken with him. Al-Qaidi was widely reported, and especially British press, to be the UK and USA's top man in Syria as the main conduit of Western aid into Aleppo, where the main battle raged at that time. And interesting about the fall of Meneg Air Base, which is also what I based a lot of my reporting on, there's all these videos in Arabic and in Russian by major regional media like Al Jazeera out there showing the aftermath of the regime base's fall, where all these rebel groups are celebrating. They weren't shy about giving interviews. And so we have Al-Qaeda sitting there praising his team, which includes an ISIS commander named Abu Jandal and other fighters. And Al-Qaeda, who only a couple months prior had, you know, been officially sanctioned by Robert Ford, and you can see media segments that deal with this, even NPR talking about Al-Qaeda and Robert Ford. You know, Robert Ford is standing around with his guys, kind of like a victorious basketball team, as the New York Times reported, praising this ISIS commander. In other interviews, we have Omar the Chechen himself standing with some of the same guys that had just been standing around Al-Qaeda, talking to the camera. These guys weren't shy about giving interviews. So there's all this profusion of old source media material online that no one has really translated. Yeah. And so, yeah, I went back and examined some of this stuff. Abu Omar is giving some interviews in Russian, which is his more comfortable language, being a Chechen and from Georgia. And he's making brief statements in Arabic to Al Jazeera. But these guys didn't hide it. And so what we see at the time is that the FSA and this nascent, emergent ISIS, they were fighting as one underneath the Revolutionary Military Council of Aleppo. And, you know, the key guy around which all of these guys sort of gathered was Colonel Abdul-Jabbar Al-Qaeda, who, by the way, didn't go away. I mean, you can still find his face on CNN.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask you, where is he now? Now that Omar the Chechen is the military leader of the Islamic State, where is Al-Qaeda? On CNN, giving interviews about why we need to call in, why we need to let these Chechens call in airstrikes against Assad, or what?
Yeah, it's amazing, because since then, Robert Ford admitted this relationship. Robert Ford gave a kind of sham attempt at an apology to McClatchy reporter Hala Alam, I think it is.
Right. I'm sorry, hold it right there, Brad. Yeah. I asked you the question way too close to the break here. We're going to be right back out with Brad Hoff from LevantReport.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Listen, a couple things before we wrap up for the week and get back to Brad in just a sec here. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to mention this earlier in the show, but I got to. There was an essay that ran in the New York Times day before yesterday about, it was written by a Yemeni about going and digging his dead sister-in-law out of the rubble after the Saudis killed her with a missile. In America's war over there, 100% American ownership of the war against Yemen going on right now. It's unbelievable to me that that was published in the New York Times, but is really something that you got to take a look at, please. And then also today, it's the spotlight on antiwar.com. I mean, yeah, and again, you wouldn't believe it. It's an essay published in the New York Times based on Phil Giraldi's essay that we interviewed him about here on the show a couple of months ago about the American deep state and how it's just like in Turkey, the national security state, the corruption, the influence peddling, the mass murder and the budget deficits. It's all there. So Phil Giraldi wrote this killer piece, and then it got written up basically in the New York Times. Who really rules America? Something like that, right along those lines. That's the spotlight today on antiwar.com and really deserves your attention. I hope you'll go and look at that. And then the other thing is, I wanted to mention that there's a reason, as you know, that you don't get to hear stuff like this anywhere else, really. And that's because there's no money in being an anti-war monger. There's plenty of money in mongering war. You know, most of the pro-war mongers, they don't ever even have to actually confront an anti-war argument because there are none being made because there is no anti-war industry. The only people who are anti-war on a steady basis, like me and antiwar.com, we rely on donations from people like you. That's it. There's no crony to be served in doing what we're doing. You understand that. And so you understand, you know, the asymmetric nature of this battle. And I think you know which side you're on. So support your local anti-warmonger. That's all. Now, speaking of anti-warmongering, check out LevantReport.com. Brad Hoff has been doing some great work there on the war in Syria. In America and our allies' role in it, the DIA report that came out and all that kind of stuff. But so where we left off, and sorry for going on so long during your interview here, Brad, but, where we left off, we were talking about this guy, Okaidi from the Free Syrian Army, his relationship with American Ambassador Robert Ford, as well as his relationship with Omar, the Chechen, Omar Shishani, the current leader of the Islamic State's military, who was also reported on by McClatchy Newspaper's Mitch Prothero this week as being actually trained by American Special Forces in the first place back in Georgia, where he's from. And then, Brad, you were addressing Robert Ford and his sort of half-apology for his work in supporting the Mujahideen there.
There's been just so much evidence that has come out that Robert Ford basically...
Wait, stop. I'm sorry, I screwed up. I hit the Skype button instead of the phone button. So you got to start over.
Yeah, so, there's been so much evidence, including video evidence, that has come out about Okaidi's relationship with Islamic State fighters that Robert Ford very recently issued a kind of apology or explanation to McClatchy News Bureau in an article written by Hannah Alam, and he made this kind of lame attempt to cover his track, saying, "Look, I called Al-Qaeda after this video surfaced and told him this is a really bad thing. I'm furious. Stop working with the Islamic State guys, or we'll cut off your paycheck." And I don't know that a lot of people know about this, partly because a lot of this, there's all these videos of these victory speeches after these various battles in Aleppo in 2013 when all these guys were working together that are untranslated. And they exist only in Arabic and in some instances with Omar the Chechen in Russian. And so they're just now kind of slowly, increasingly being translated.
Hey, you know what? You send me those Omar the Chechen interviews and I'll have my wife translate them. She's Ukrainian.
Oh,
she speaks Russian.
Yeah, that's great. I know that in one of the videos that is linked to in my article, he gives his interview primarily in Russian. I do know that he talks fundamentally about how the FSA had been attacking Meneg Air Base for about 8 months, and so he's praising the FSA in a much later interview with a Russian pro-jihadi website. He actually talks about his relationship with the FSA, the U.S.-backed fighters, as being pragmatic. Basically, he says, so long as they don't get in our way, we don't fight them. We're not fighting the whole of the FSA, only the ones that, are not on board with our vision of an Islamic State. I think the most interesting, most bizarre part of my article comes at the end. Everyone needs to check out Okaidi given like 8 minutes of virtually uninterrupted airtime on Christian Amanpour's show, simply called Amanpour. Mm-hmm. This is supposed to be like the flagship foreign affairs show for CNN, and this is July 2015. I mean, you got to see this. They set him up with a translator. They give him like 6 to 8 full minutes to appeal to Western countries and the American people that the U.S. should imply a no-fly zone and a buffer zone for the sake of the so-called moderate rebels. But at the same time, you can see his face all over the internet posing with known ISIS commanders from 2013.
Yeah.
So I don't get it.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I don't get it. I just don't get it.
Oh, yeah. Well, nah, sure you do. It's all about weakening Iran's influence because that's what our allies want over there and that kind of thing. But now, and I want to point out here about McClatchy newspapers that, you know, we got some friends there do some really good journalism, like David Enders, who was covering, he's not there anymore, but he was covering the early part of the Syria war very early on. And I believe it was him. And, you know, Roy Gutman, he's bad on some things. Yeah, maybe a lot of things, but he does some really good journalism too, sometimes. But they reported, and it may have even been Hannah Lom or Nancy Youssef, I forget exactly now, who McClatchy was, but they reported very early on in this war. If it was 2012, it could have been early 2013, I think probably more likely it was 2012, saying that, you know, the Obama administration is saying that, yes, this Nusra Front, the Association of Helpers or whatever they call themselves, these guys are nothing but Al-Qaeda in Iraq. We recognize them as such and we ban any support to them. And this is very early on. So there's no playing dumb about the Islamic State, you know, which didn't really break off again or attempt to rename Nusra ISIS, and then they had the fight between Golani and Baghdadi about who was who and who was taking orders and whatever, but that didn't even really happen until the spring of 2013. So,
right.
You know, we're still talking about, you know, Al-Qaeda at that time and where the government completely admitted it. Of course, Ben Swan, the great libertarian journalist Ben Swan, confronted Barack Obama about this to his face. He said, you're drone bombing Pakistan and Yemen to kill Al-Qaeda, but you're backing them in Syria. Why? And Obama says, oh, well, blah, 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 about something about vetting them and making sure that only moderates get our support. But meanwhile, as you're saying, this is going on right at the very same time where, and you know what, even at the Small Wars Journal and places like that, they're no libertarians or non-interventionists or whatever, but they've been screaming their head off for years about, look at Al-Qaeda guys with American weapons that they obviously got from the FSA, you know?
Right, right. And it's a real practical matter. I mean, one does not need to make it an elaborate, intentional CIA plot. You know, I'm going to quote from Mitch Prothera's excellent article this week. You know, he quotes a Georgian army soldier that had fought alongside Omar the Chechen before he was, you know, the big, you know, radical Omar the Chechen. He said, we were well trained by American Special Forces units, and he was the star pupil. So when he shows up with his band of radicals in northern Syria in 2012 and 2013, you know what? It's a fight for their lives. They want the best fighters. They want the best fighters, even the U.S.-backed Colonel Al-Qaeda. He wants the best fighters. Who are the best fighters but the Al-Qaeda radicals? It just makes so much sense.
And, you know, it makes sense, too, that the CIA would say, well, we know this guy. He's all right. And might not see, you know, the way Prothero writes it, he really made a change from one guy to the other sort of a thing. But really, it makes sense that they would have seen him as maybe not so bad. They got his documents right here.
Right. Yeah. No one would foresee that ISIS would become this sort of ultra scary boogeyman, the sort of new international terror brand that you know, hear about every moment you get in your car and turn on NPR. I mean, like I said earlier, ISIS at the time was just another group, and reporting on ISIS only slowly started to emerge that fall of 2013. And so then it becomes more of a sort of public relations nightmare as we look back on all of this, like, source material video footage. I mean, from, like, Al Jazeera, legitimate established regional outlets who are showing all these ISIS guys hanging out with all the FSA guys who guys like Robert Ford are very publicly vouching for.
Right.
And so if people go to my article, I want them to spend time clicking on these links, watching the videos. And one of the links is a translated montage that it's had independent confirmation in terms of the accuracy of the translations from the Arabic. Joshua Landis at the University of Oklahoma at one point promoted this video on his Twitter account. It's still not had the kind of viewership it needs. RT News this summer kind of played it over and over again when it reported on the 2012 DIA document. But more people need to see this stuff, and then CNN can't get away with allowing Colonel Al-Qaeda to just continue to get up there and propagandize the American people on its flagship program. But of course, when you listen to Amanpour, I mean, that's basically like listening to the State Department itself, right?
Yeah, exactly. And always has been, too. She's even married to a guy. She, at the time that they were getting the, that she was very much helping to get the Kosovo War going, she was married to the State Department spokesman. As they were, and they were like newlyweds too, newly in love, as they're telling the story to the Americans of why we got a free Kosovo for the KLA, you know, the Bin Ladenites of the Balkans, basically. But yeah, and now the thing is though about no one could see in the Islamic State just another group. I think I'll differ with you a little bit there. Again, it was known. I mean, Al Qaeda in Iraq renamed itself the Islamic State of Iraq for the first time back in 2006, and back then it was a pipe dream. But it was pretty clear what their agenda was. And at the time that they broke off, and again back to McClatchy News, at the time that they were fighting with al-Nusra over who was in charge and what their plan was, and and all of that, they were making clear right then. That was, you know, publicly in the papers in the spring of 2013, early in 2013, that these guys were fighting, and what the Islamic State group wanted was to create a state. And then it came out, I guess, a couple of months later, maybe a month later, that Zawahiri had taken the side of Golani and told Baghdadi to go back to Iraq. And then Baghdadi said, I'll go back to Iraq when I'm good and ready. And how are you going to enforce your commands from your mom's basement in Pakistan, boss, and whatever? Right. And that was where the big fight came from. But then, and as you've documented, beyond anyone else, and as you just referred to, the DIA document warning that these guys could create an Islamic State and even import it back into Iraq, into lawless Western Iraq, is a real danger. They warned that in August of 2012, the same time it was being warned about by the likes of Patrick Coburn on this show.
No, you're exactly right. You know, and I think government insiders, they knew and they know what's going on. And I think people that follow closely like you, like people that follow antiwar.com, for example, I think they're going to know. But middle, you know, kind of middle America guy, clicking on his primetime news at home, you know, if he sees a group called Northern Storm Brigade and John McCain standing beside them in northern Syria, I mean, he's not going to know. Yeah, but speaking of Northern Storm Brigade, actually, the article was kind of getting too long, so I didn't want to cover that. But there's a lot of video footage of Northern Storm Brigade also on the battlefield that day, August 6th,
with these guys?
2013.
Oh, great. Yeah. Now that, yeah, that's a hugely important one, because those are the guys where, and of course, I got the clip actually of McCain saying, oh, we can vet these guys. It's fine. We can vet them. But the Northern Storm Brigade was on video being interviewed by Time Magazine before John McCain ever went over there, saying, yeah, we're veterans of the Iraq War, where we fought with Zarqawi against the Americans. And then after he went and hung out with them over there, a couple of years later, it turned out, well, actually soon after, it turned out that they had been involved in the kidnapping of some Shia religious pilgrim civilians from Lebanon. But then it also came out later on that they were the ones who had sold Sotloff, Stephen Sotloff, to ISIS, who later cut his head off, the American journalist over there. These were John McCain's, those are the guys. Unlike in some of the conspiracy stuff said these were, that was Baghdadi on the port. It wasn't Baghdadi, but it was guys who were buddies with Baghdadi and willing to sell American prisoners to Baghdadi. So same damn difference. The fact that John McCain is still in the Senate right now is just, it's just a tribute to the ignorance of the American people on this issue. That's it. Because there's just no question of how scandalous that truly is if it was understood.
Anyone with lesser political status would be in prison right now, for sure. But yeah, I'll try to dig up that. There's some source video out there. Again, it's in Arabic, so we haven't had a lot of exposure to it this side of the world. But yeah, there's a lot of untranslated video out there.
You know what? Send me the ones that you think. Send me the ones that you think are like the maybe two or three very most important ones of those videos, and I'll see if maybe I can think of who I might could get to translate them for us.
Sure, yeah, sure, I'll work on that. But yep, Northern Storm Brigade, the John McCain's group, they are there at Minig Air Base fighting alongside of Omar the Chechen and you know his fearsome Islamic State fighters. He's sending those suicide bombers in like they're nothing as well. Which, as I mentioned in the article, Benjamin Hall, this author of Inside ISIS, he talks about when they showed up. They show up with this sort of aura, you know, this mystique, and everyone looks up to them. It almost, you know, I kind of struggled to interpret this as, well, is the FSA commanding the ISIS jihadi units, or is it the ISIS jihadi units commanding the FSA at the Battle of Meneg Air Base? And I kind of presented it as really there's a kind of cooperative, unified command. But guess what? They're all under the official FSA structured that at that time had been funded officially by the State Department. And in one of the last videos I post, if you watch near the end of this long Omar the Chechen video, they've got some sleek communication devices. Make note of that.
Yeah. Well, there's pictures of some of these guys standing in USAID tents. It's got National Endowment for Democracy written on this or something. I guess it says USAID written all over it, you know, and don't even hide
it. Right, you know. Exactly. There's another guy that's really gotten away with a lot, hasn't had much coverage. If anyone has some energy, they'd need to call him up, investigate this. But Congressman Adam Kinzinger, congressman from Illinois, he went in September 2014. He was hanging out with the same Colonel Okaydi in Turkey, trying to bolster support for some newly formed group of moderates. I think that's where Okaydi hangs out now, just in Turkish resorts, giving CNN interviews, but CNN footage of Congressman Adam Kinzinger hanging out with, a guy that had once exercised operational command over ISIS.
Yep. All right, now, we're over time here anyway. If you got to go, you got to go, but otherwise, I want to ask you one more thing.
Sure, shoot.
Okay, so this is a very good point, and it's one that I absolutely assent to here. First was the tweet by Charles Lister, the Al-Qaeda expert at the Brookings Institution, who, by the way, recently reported that there's a room, he called it, in Turkey where Americans and Saudis run the Army of Conquest, which includes the Al-Nusra Front. How exactly that plays into Al-Nusra's betrayal of the DOD-trained few dozen there a couple of weeks ago, I'm not exactly sure. But then, more important, I think, to address is Moon of Alabama, which is a great blog, and they're really great on Ukraine and Syria issues and a lot of things here. And they respond to him, hey, how come, I'm sorry. Lister says, an 80% increase in U.S. trained and equipped fighters deployed in Syria from 5 to 9, 11 more on their way, right? So he's joking, and this is the big joke going around about how few of the DOD-trained mythical moderates were able to do a damn thing. And again, it was Prothero who reported in McClatchy, based on many, many sources, good ones it seemed, about how the Turks had al-Nusra kill these guys, betray them, and kill some and kidnap the rest and this kind of deal. But then Moon of Alabama says, hey, Charles Lister, how come you always, quote, forget the 10,000 the CIA had deployed before the before the DOD ever did any of this? So, and then he makes a crack about, does taking Qatari money lead to amnesty? Amnesia, I guess he's trying to say.
Right.
And Qatari money being a reference to who funds the Brookings Institution, of course, there. But so right. That is the deal, is there were thousands and thousands of these guys. Again, McClatchy, the great Jonathan Landay, has told me, hey, I've seen these guys. I went with CIA to the bases in Jordan where they've been training them for years. And then, but he says they mostly amount to just a National Guard to keep the Islamic State out of Jordan. And that's basically it at this point. But, I don't know. And I don't know about 10,000, but what do you know about that?
I like to think that a lot of your sort of run-of-the-mill military guys are a little bit smarter, and I'm almost thinking this whole train and equip mission has gone so horribly. There's almost it seems like a purposeful slow playing. But of course we know the CIA can do anything at once because there's no accountability or oversight. We're never going to know ultimately. I mean, until we have some declassified documents like 20, 30 years from now, right? But I think the official Pentagon Train and Equip program, I don't know that we can be that stupid as far as this, we put out 5 U.S.-backed rebels. I think there's almost a purposeful slow playing, I think. Maybe, maybe everyone's afraid of going to jail 5 years down the road when there's a new administration, right? But, you know, as far as the CIA and this whole thing goes, I think it's a matter of keeping options on the table. You know, I think it's a matter of keeping options on the table. If you want to make a case for a regime change, you can always just say, hey, our CIA and Pentagon-trained guys came under attack by Assad forces, so we're going to hit them now. I mean, I think a lot of this is partly about keeping options on the table. As Hillary famously said, keep skin in the game. Of course, it's not her skin, is it?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I guess now I got to let you go so that you can race over to CNN International and watch Christian Amanpour interviewing Samantha Power about how the dastardly Russians are trying to kill all of our al-Qaeda friends in Syria, and they must, you know, cease and desist immediately.
Here we go. Exactly.
America. All right. The state of the American Empire in September of 2015. Take note, everybody. Thanks very much for your time on the show again, Brad. It's great to talk to you, man.
All right. Enjoyed it. Appreciate it, Scott.
Great
Thank
work
you.
Here. All right, y'all. That is Brad Hoff. He's at LevantReport.com, an American veteran, and lived in Syria for a while. ISIS leader Omar al-Shashani fought under U.S. umbrella as late as 2013, a follow-up to Mitch Prothero's great reporting in McClatchy this week about how he was originally trained by American Special Forces in Georgia in the first place. Thanks very much for listening. Wherever time, that's it for the week. See you Sunday morning on KPFK.